You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a controversial homeless proposal in Eureka, protests by postal workers, and a lawsuit against a dairy farm in Del Norte County. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, environment, and energy reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Jane, you covered a really long meeting at the Eureka City Council this week. What were they talking about for 7.5 hours?
Yes, it was a 7.5 hour long meeting. And basically, they have a proposed ordinance that would regulate sitting, laying, and camping in public, which is basically trying to regulate homelessness in the city. They're trying to combine two ordinances they currently have. So one of them governs camping, one of them governs sitting and laying. And they say those two are confusing. They're trying to repeal those two and make one new ordinance. And so all of this discussion is happening because, as we've discussed before, in June 2024, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that upholding public camping laws is not cruel and unusual punishment. There was this longstanding legal battle focused on Grants Pass. And so that ruling has really upended the legal precedent for regulating homelessness. And so a lot of cities like Eureka are now sort of rethinking their ordinances and looking at them again. And so this proposed ordinance would set out rules for sitting, laying, and camping in public. It also has things like you can't go to the bathroom in public. That's not allowed. And if you violate this ordinance, it's been upgraded to a misdemeanor. So that means potentially a $1,000 fine and a year in jail. But the thing with this ordinance is, rather than going to jail, the offender could choose to instead be taken to social services, like substance use or mental health treatment.
So what do supporters of this proposal say?
They're basically saying that this is offering an incentive for homeless people to accept help. Maybe they haven't accepted help before, they haven't wanted it, or it hasn't worked. Some people brought up this idea of anosognosia, which is when someone is basically unaware that they might need help or unaware they might have a psychiatric condition, they don't understand they might need help. So there's sort of this carrot or stick idea to try to encourage people to get the help they need. Some people say it's giving people accountability. And so if you accept, then you start a social service program, you complete whatever your goals are, whatever barriers you're facing, and then your charges will get dropped if you complete those goals, and then hopefully you're closer to getting whatever it is that you need. So that's sort of their argument, the city's argument. And there are a lot of people at the meeting, or at least some, that did support the ordinance. The executive director of the Eureka Rescue Mission, the president of the Humboldt County chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There were some other organizations, a business owner, that did say that this is a step in the right direction.
Anosognosia, I think we've all just learned a new word.
Yes.
but what do opponents say? Why are they against this?
So there were way more opponents than there were supporters at the meeting. Dozens of residents were in opposition to this during public comment. They basically say that it's criminalizing homelessness, criminalizing poverty. A couple people said that just because the Supreme Court has ruled that the city can legally do this does not mean that they should. Some people brought up that having a criminal record can be a barrier to finding jobs or housing in the future. So if someone turns down the help or doesn't complete it, you know, if they end up getting charged or having a record. Some people also didn't like the idea of forcing people to accept help if they're not ready to accept it. And some people also brought up the irony, as they saw it, that Eureka recently declared itself a sanctuary city, and some people were asking a sanctuary for who, which they saw it as hypocritical. So there was definitely a lot of people speaking against this proposed ordinance.
So after such a long conversation, did the Eureka City Council actually come to a decision?
They did not. So 7.5 hour long meeting, they kept extending it. The meeting lasted until 1:30 in the morning. But like I said, it's just a proposed ordinance. It hasn't been enacted yet. And they basically voted to just table it to discuss it at a future meeting. And that date hasn't been set. So it'll come back at some point and we'll have to see what their final decision is then.
And Roman, you were down in Reading yesterday, and you stopped by a protest in front of a post office. What were they protesting there?
Yeah, they were not protesting the post office necessarily. They were protesting against downsizing and possible privatization of the U.S. Postal Service. There were probably like – I was trying to count. It's kind of hard when it's just a bunch of people lined up on the streets. But there were probably like 100-plus people at this one in Reading. But there were lots of protests around the country organized by the Union of USPS Workers as part of this day of action to try and raise awareness for this. So they were in support of the USPS and the services it provides to people. And most people there, it seemed, were residents who were kind of there in solidarity and not postal workers themselves, because a lot of them were working.
Yeah, they had a job to do, deliver the mail. Well, what kind of challenges is the Postal Service facing right now?
Yeah, there's lots of challenges and threats to the independence of the Postal Service. The original form of the USPS was created in 1775, basically a year and a month before the Declaration of Independence, so making it older than the U.S. itself.
Wow.
And the post office was part of the executive branch for a long time until it was eventually spun off as an independent agency in 1971. And so now it's independently controlled by this board that's appointed by the president. It's also supposed to be self-financed through stamps and package, you know, what people pay for delivering packages. But for a long time, except for a brief period in the early 2000s, the USPS has not turned a profit. It loses billions of dollars every year. And Trump has, you know, previously proposed privatizing the agency in his last term, but that got a lot of disapproval in Congress. He's complained about the fact that the agency loses all of this money. And, you know, this time around, now that he's back in office, that effort has come back. Louis DeJoy, who's the current Postmaster General, was appointed under Trump and has, you know, remained in effect in the USPS through the Biden administration. And, you know, he's done a lot to downsize the workforce there, shrink operations. In Oregon, we reported on efforts that they did to consolidate post office operations where, you know, if you send a letter in Medford, it first is going to go up to Portland to get processed before it gets sent anywhere else, even if you're mailing it to your neighbor across the street. So, you know, a lot of that is what he says are budget-saving measures to try and get the USPS to turn a profit or at least make some money so that they're self-financed. But, you know, postal workers complain that they're just making services worse or, you know, worse than that, that he's trying to sabotage the agency to pave the way for privatization. So DeJoy recently also said that he's cutting another 10,000 workers at the agency and he's going to work with Elon Musk and DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. So there's definite worries that some or all of the USPS could be privatized. What seems most likely would be a spinoff of the package delivery service itself as a private company and then keeping the mail as a government agency because there's more kind of requirements or legal obligations to deliver mail to every address. So that mail part might remain as part of the government.
Okay. Well, what would downsizing or privatizing the Postal Service, how would that affect services, especially, you know, like where you were around Reading is a lot of rural areas.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a lot of rural areas in our region. And, you know, we would definitely see a lot of the worst impacts for these rural areas. Postal workers say there would be more job cuts. And, you know, worse than that, we could also see the closing of post offices that don't turn a profit. When I was talking with postal workers at this protest, they noted a few post offices that don't turn a profit, and those would probably be closed, which means that people would have to travel much further to visit a post office. You could also see major increases in prices. There was this report from Wells Fargo that said that the USPS would have to raise prices by 30 to 140% in some areas to compete with private package delivery companies. And so that would make it more difficult for people who rely on the USPS for things like medicine and groceries, especially in rural areas, not to mention the concern with the fact the USPS delivers a lot of election mail. A lot of people vote using the mail.
So what are protesters hoping to do about this?
Yeah, essentially what they're trying to do here is trying to raise awareness about, you know, what the USPS higher-ups are trying to do with this and how it could impact them. I mean, you know, when you talk with a lot of people, the USPS is broadly pretty popular, especially in rural areas where it's relied upon more. It's not necessarily a partisan thing. It's also pretty popular in Congress upon across party lines. A lot of Republicans in this area like Doug LaMalfa and Cliff Bentz support the USPS. So, you know, any change that would require congressional approval would probably be really difficult to push through because it is a pretty popular agency. And I think that's why a lot of people, you know, are showing up to protests like this, because they do really support the work that the USPS does.
Yeah, well, thank you, Roman. Justin, you reported on a class action lawsuit against a local dairy farm. Can you tell us about who's getting sued here?
Yeah, so the Alexander Family Farm in Del Norte County is getting sued, and this has to do with their certified humane label. So this is a pretty large farm. They have nearly 10,000 cows and really one of the largest organic dairy farms in the country. They sell this really popular milk, this A2 organic milk, which I'm sure you've seen. I have it in my fridge. I'm not sure why I buy it, but supposedly it has like this different protein that is easily digested. But they sell their milk really around the country, especially in Whole Foods and like organic shops. A lot of shops here in Ashland sell it, of course. And the farm has marketed itself as really a more ethical alternative than factory dairy farms.
And so what's the problem?
So on their website, they talk about how their cows, you know, roam free on open green pastures. They're proponents of regenerative farming, which is better for the environment. They refer to their style of farming as holistic management. They're certified organic, so they don't give their cows certain antibiotics, but they're also certified humane. That designation comes from a nonprofit, Humane Animal Farm Care, which has a set of standards for farms and how they treat their animals. And if you follow these standards, then they get that certified humane label. And people pay a premium for Alexander Family Farm milk. It costs more than normal milk, at least in part probably because of this certified humane label. So those people that want to drink milk more ethically will buy their milk. This lawsuit claims that the farm doesn't follow those humane guidelines. And the complaint represents, it's a class action lawsuit, so the class represented here are those buying the farm's milk who think they're getting milk from a humanely treated cows, but the lawsuit basically claims that they were lied to.
So what is the lawsuit claiming really happened on the farm?
A lot of stuff, and it gets pretty graphic. They include a lot of photos in the complaint itself. You know, just to be sure, these are allegations that's going to go to court. But some of the examples are, you know, calves, baby cows are left in these dirty hutches. Hutches are these little enclosures that kind of they're put in, covered in mud and filth for a month longer than the certified humane guideline allows. So that humane guideline does allow the calves to be in hutches for a certain amount of time, but the allegations are that this farm is keeping these calves in there longer. They don't have outdoor access. They're not like playing with other cows. Staff allegedly pour salt into the eyes of cows and then glue denim patches over those eyes when a cow has like an eye infection or eye cancer. I spoke with someone and he claims, you know, there's no medical benefit for that. But it seems like the allegations are they're doing that because they can't give the cows antibiotics. There's an instance of a staff cutting off a cow's teat with a pocket knife. They saw off hundreds of cow's horns without pain medication. This stuff obviously isn't allowed under the certified humane label. So a lot of allegations are being thrown out there. And if true, that would surprise consumers buying a certified humane product and spending that extra money for this milk where they think the cows are being treated much better.
And just to emphasize, these are allegations, but like where are we getting these from? Who's making them?
A lot of the information comes from a report released by the animal advocacy group Farm Forward last year, and that relied on a lot of whistleblower accounts and videos and photographs provided to that group. The Atlantic Monthly magazine also had a big feature on that farm and generally the topic of ethical dairies. I checked this morning and the Alexander Family Farm is still listed by Humane Animal Farm Care as being certified humane. The farm did respond in a statement and they denied the allegations. They said, here's a quote, "Our mission is to farm in harmony with nature and to honor the earth and all of the animals under our stewardship." And they said they look forward to fighting the allegations in court.
So I think this brings up a bigger issue, ethical labels on food products. What should we know there?
Yeah, so I spoke with Andrew DeCoriolis. He's the executive director at that animal advocacy group, Farm Forward. And he said that's kind of the big takeaway point here. Here's Coriolis.
You know, we get asked all the time, what should, you know, from people who send us an email and say, hey, what should I be buying? What brands? And my answer right now, unfortunately, is you have to be very skeptical of these labels. You have to look at them in the same way you might environmental and climate marketing from an oil company, and you have to make your decisions accordingly.
So it's good to understand there is a financial incentive for farms to get labels like certified humane or organic, and that's because people are willing to pay more. So a company could make more money off these labels. The plaintiffs in this complaint are also suing the organization that gives out these labels, and it's asking for more than $5 million in damages and a jury trial. So we'll be following this case and see how the farm responds to these allegations and see what more evidence the plaintiffs bring to court.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like something a lot of people would be interested in, and that there's more to come on that. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should be covering in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or any of the other podcast platforms.